And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. Tonight, Laura comes try night flight group at Triangle. Sober since March of 2009. Just right about that time period, I went over to the Gwinnett room to catch a meeting where Gary and Bill were, and I guess you were there, and you sat with us afterwards for lunch, and that was the first time I'd met you. And I remember thinking that this young lady's really got a chance. She really has a chance. So with that, let's give you a chance right here. Welcome.
All right, of course, I didn't think I was going to be nervous, but I am, so. My name's Lauren, I'm an alcoholic. I guess I'll start out, I've been sober since March 2nd, 2009. I was born on March 12th of 1987, so that makes me 24, which I'm doing math. So I guess I'm supposed to tell you, like Tim said, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'll try to get through what it was like as quickly as possible while still qualifying as an alcoholic. I am the oldest of two. I have two younger brothers. Grew up, my childhood all up until I was 10 was, you know, pretty normal. I think I had in me already those things that we talk about so much, that fear, felt like I was different, felt like I was less than. But yeah, I mean, I had a couple friends and things were good. And then when I was 10, really the first big event in my life that needs to be talked about was my parents got separated. And that was due to the fact, which is interesting since we're in an AA setting, that my dad got sober. And my mom said, well, it's, you know, this is basically the last thing they had in common. So, but at the time, it didn't really affect me that much, or at least I didn't think it did. I kind of saw it coming. Maybe I was, I don't know, a perceptive child, but there's two times where my mom told me something. She, like, sat me down. And both times I knew what she was going to tell me. One was when she told me that they were going to get a divorce, and the second time was when she told me that she was going to get remarried. And both times I was like, okay, can we get this over with? You know, I know what you're going to say. I don't care, you know. I guess just through the divorce, what I think affected me the most was just, I mean, this is no fault of my parents. I mean, marriages don't work all the time. Just all the moving around and stuff. There was this added instability and added just stress, like looking back on it. But through that and through, I guess, not having home life really that stable, middle school comes in. And I still think of middle school as like this black hole of death. When I think about it now, I'm not to be overdramatic, but it was just a really hard time for me. I was really awkward, very kind of the ugly duckling, and I just didn't fit in at all, and I really, really wanted to. And I just felt like a square peg in a round hole, definitely. And it was around that time that I really started just hating myself a lot, just really didn't want to live, but I didn't see any way out. I had no hope, really, so I experimented with, like, cutting and stuff like that, and, I mean, it's common. There's a lot of, you know, young teenagers today that do it, and it's because they don't have hope, they don't have God, you know, they see all this stuff that our media and stuff tells them that they need to be, and they're not it, and that's how I felt. And I also just, and I had my one close friend, but outside of her, and maybe one or other two other friends, like, I wasn't the cool kid, I was kind of a loser, and it was just really hard for me as someone who really, really wanted to be liked, and really wanted to fit in. But yeah, finally got through middle school, and I got to high school, and it was, you know, I was just dying to, like, find something, remake myself, something, anything. And at the end of my freshman year, my dad took me and my best friend Jennifer to Daytona for spring break, and that is where I had my first drink. And it's, Bill talks about this sentence. It's so funny that we all relate so much to Bill when he's like this guy in like the 1930s stockbroker. But when he says, "I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, well, I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol." But that part where he says, but he says, "I had arrived." You know, like, here was life, here was excitement, here was all those things. I was finally part of life, and that's how I felt. I found something that worked for me, and I held on to it. I was like, this is where I'm going to find my identity. This is where I can be cool, because I can be, you know, I can be the smart kid who parties, you know, like, I can kind of break the mold in that. And so I went off, and it's funny that he says, like, "I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink," because I knew both sides of my family were very strongly alcoholic. My grandfather on my mom's side died of alcoholism at the age of like 68 or something like that, and when I was young, and you know, of course, since I was 10, my dad had been going to meetings. I knew that was in my blood, but I just didn't care. And I mean, I think it's, somebody just asked me the other night too, that they were in the program and they had this young daughter, and they were like, "What should I do?" And I was like, "You can't do anything." You know, you can tell them all day, like, you're probably, if you're gonna, you know, my dad said, like, if you try that stuff, you're gonna like it, and you're probably not gonna be able to control it. It didn't mean anything. It takes what it takes, you know. We have to go our own way sometimes because we're really stubborn. But I found my solution, and I just ran with it. But things really took off my sophomore year. So fast forward like 6 months after my first drink, I met, you know, the older guy, and that was it for me. Now I had wheels. I had a way to go out. I had this new group of friends, and very quickly things got into another gear, if you will. I started experimenting with outside issues. This is NAVA, so I'll keep it as clean as possible, but it's hard to kind of tell my story without them. So, within a very short period of time, I would say within that year, so within my sophomore year, I had tried pretty much every drug under the sun, besides for, like, the really hard stuff, which really made you an addict, which was, like, heroin or something. I never did that. But really just because, honestly, I never came across my path, which is just the grace of God, because I bet, given the right set of circumstances, I would have gone for it. And that's really just what I did for the rest of high school, because of the gifts that God has blessed me with. I was able to be a functional, you know, alcoholic and drug addict, because I really feel like right off the bat I was. Just some of the stuff I would do where I would stay out all night on a school night until 6 in the morning all the time, just for no good reason, you know, just because I needed to. Because I needed to get out of right here, right now. And but I was able to function. You know, I graduated high school with a 3.6 or 3.7. And that's not really... I got a lot of identity from that. Because I'm like, oh, I can do all this stuff, and I can still function. I can still... I don't know. I got a lot of pride out of that. But then we get to college, and just things started catching up with me very quickly. I went to Georgia State, moved into the dorms, and things definitely went up another gear where it was drugs, alcohol every day. Because in high school, you know, when you're living at home, you're kind of, you can't do that. all the time, because you don't have your own place, you're still under some sort of rules, even though I broke them every chance I got. That was it, you know, but I was still able to function. I'm still dating that older guy who's Brent, and that, when I hit college, that relationship, which was already as dysfunctional as possibly could be, kind of hit another level when it got just abusive. And it was both ways, and I can look back at it now and not be a victim, but that was definitely another thing that was driving me to drink, because I couldn't deal with him. I couldn't live with or without him. You know, that old cliche. I couldn't break it off, even though, like, things would happen, things would get physical, and I would just go right back, you know, because I didn't have, whatever you want to say, like, the self-control or the self-worth, the self-confidence, anything to stop it. I was literally, one of the things that I've realized when I came in is, like, I have an addiction to drugs and alcohol, but I also have an addiction to relationships. And it's been really cool to see God really take me out of that as well, as, you know, we continue to peel the onion. When I was 19, this is my sophomore year of college, I had, you know, just been basically doing what we do all day, every day. Still managed to get okay grades. I lost hope. So you can tell that I really wasn't applying myself. I was just trying to get by. I just can remember very distinctly being like, well, as long as I keep a 3.0, I don't give a rip, you know, like, whatever. I can do what I want, you know. But I didn't keep it. And so that was one of those things that, those standards that I set for myself that I failed at, because I was, because drink was more important. 19, I end up in, I don't know how much I should talk about. Basically, the, like, all the drugs I've been doing and the alcohol, it started to catch up to me, and I was one of those people where I started to drink to get rid of anxiety and fear, and it got to be where I couldn't be in social situations without alcohol or drugs. But then it was funny, because then, especially with the drugs, I couldn't be in social situations with them. So it was like really this horrible thing where I was like, okay, I can't put my hand on that hot stove again, because I know I'm going to like probably freak out and have an anxiety attack. But then I couldn't do it. I couldn't say no. So when I was 19, basically another, like, you know, spring break vacation just went really bad. Don't really need to get into it, but I hit a bottom. And just all my friends hated me because of what happened, and, you know, and I was just completely demoralized and was definitely having suicidal thoughts, didn't want to live. And that's when I went to the hospital with my mom just to, like, get evaluated or something. Like, I didn't really think anything. I just really wanted them to give me something, like, give me something so I can deal with my life, you know, put me on some antidepressants, give me some, you know, whatever, maybe something stronger. But and so I showed up at that hospital, and I got 1013 to Peachford, because I said something about a knife, and they don't really take that as, like, you know, you're joking or anything. And so they took me to Peachford, and that was my first rehab kind of experience. And in there, I really, like, I was so still in denial, and I really wasn't done. I was miserable, but I really didn't think, I thought there was something wrong with me as a person. You know, like it says, like, in our literature, or at least everyone says in the meetings, like, we're not bad people trying to get good, we're sick people trying to get well. Well, I thought I was a bad person, and I just didn't, and I also didn't think that, like, that the drugs and alcohol were the problem. I thought I was the problem, which I am, but I wasn't ready to let go of that. So basically, you know, I get a big book, and my dad actually gave me one when I was in there, and I remember reading Bill's story, and I remember being like, this is interesting. But then, you know, it sat on my shelf for 2 more years, and I went and did what I needed to do to get in here and to get willing to do what it takes, because we all know that it takes work to be sober, and if you're not willing, then if you're not willing to be honest and open, then you can't do this thing. So it was basically just 2 more years of just, wow. I talked about, you know, just the black hole of death. That was just how that was, because I was just so paralyzed by fear, especially those last 2 years when, like, something in my subconscious or, I don't know, just knew something was really wrong and just couldn't deal with life anymore. I started doing things like just isolating a lot more, being really afraid of people. When I first came in, those promises, fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us, that fear of people thing really got my attention, because I couldn't, it's funny now, knowing who I am today, but I could really not have a conversation with anyone, even family sometimes. I was so paralyzed by fear and what you were thinking about me. And wanting to impress you, and just all that stuff that's so, like, pride in reverse, if that makes sense. Just, I was so obsessed about me, but how bad I was. And so, basically, this just keeps going on. I keep pursuing, you know, just everything that goes with that lifestyle. Drugs, music, anything. And I, what finally really just hit me another bottom was that relationship that I'd been in since I was 15, finally after 6 years of on again, off again, and just horrible, just cycle of abuse and me going back, finally ended, in the summer of 2008, because he got a new girlfriend. And so that was hard, because, I was the one who was supposed to be the one who rejected him, and now all of a sudden he's happy. And so that, man, that last 6 months of my using was really, really difficult. But I'm grateful for it now, because it got me, it finally got me out of that cycle and that just that lie that, like, everything was okay. And it gave me one last thing to run to. And the alcohol just wouldn't cover that wound anymore. It wasn't enough. And so, basically, I did some, in January 2009, so let's get sober. In January of 2009, I did hard drugs again. I don't need to say which, but very hard drugs for the first time in a while, let's say. Like, maybe like 6-9 months or something. And it really just, I think it brought me into psychosis or something like that. I was out there. I was gone. And I was actually driving I have 2 younger brothers, the middle one, his name's Paul. I was driving him up to Annapolis so he could go to the Naval Academy, and I was just all still on this drug and with my friends. And it had been one of those things where, like, I hadn't really been planning on doing it the night before, but then it was in my face and I did it. You know, I don't even know why I went out to the club that night. It's because, what else do you do? You know? So when it's like, it talks about in the big book, like, we have some important engagement to keep and then we just blow it up. You know, that's exactly what I did. And so just through that experience of, like, really just getting in a really just psychosis, I think I was up for like at least 3 days. I just couldn't sleep. That's where I really hit a bottom. But it took me another month to check myself into my second treatment at Summer Ridge. And this time I went willingly. I went to the you know, evaluation thing. I was like, I really need help. I really need help. And I went in there and I was gonna, you know, do this thing. But I was still really sick. And so I'm in there for a week, and I leave immediately and go to Rhode Island with my mom to go to a wedding. My mom, I don't think I mentioned this, is a pretty functional alcoholic. I can't, you know, you can't diagnose anyone, but with her history and the way I've seen her drink, she is, but she's functional, so she hasn't had the gift of that bottom yet, to see that there's a different way to live. So I go to this wedding, so I obviously I drink, and there's this period where I'm, like, dating this guy that I meet in treatment, and about a month long, and then he actually, like, relapses on pills, and then I'm on pills, and then finally he almost dies about on March 1st, 2009 from an overdose, and he like stops breathing and all this stuff, and the next day both of us pick up our white chips. And a week later, my sponsor, who I got at my first meeting by the grace of God, told me, you can either, you can jump, okay, I want to make sure I say this right. It's like, it's a suggestion to wear a parachute, but like, you probably will die if you jump out of the plane. What she was telling me is like, you do not need to be in this relationship if you're serious about your sobriety. And so I broke it off with that guy and put on my parachute. I can't say that was my last relationship in my first year, because that would be a lie. But it was through decisions like that, that really making hard choices like that, that got me to where I am today. So I started working the steps off, right off the bat, and I needed that. I needed solution. I did not need to just sit and just go to meetings. I think I would have definitely wouldn't have made it. So started going through the book with my sponsor. Step one, at that point it was pretty easy for me to see that I was powerless over alcohol. And for me, and I'll still say this today, that I was just so happy that I had like a disease that had a solution, that had this like, okay, just go, you know, go through these steps and like something will happen. I was just, because I had, I didn't mention this, but especially the last year that I was out there, I was like really diagnosing myself with all the stupid crap that I had, like, oh, I have multiple personality disorders, that must be what it is, you know, like, I'm bipolar, like anything, like, that wasn't alcoholism. And so when I finally got in and read the doctor's opinion with my sponsor and heard about the physical allergy and heard about the mental obsession and the spiritual malady, I was like, wow, like this thing is like, this is legit. Like there, this really is a disease. And it was just a huge relief. So I just went after this thing with, I mean, I can't say as much enthusiasm as I went after drinking, but I went after it. So in step, I got to the God thing, step two, and I was one of those, I wish I remembered where it says this, actually I think it's at the beginning of, okay, it's talking about how we have doubted God. We know how it feels. We have shared his honest doubt and prejudice. Some of us have been violently anti-religious. To others, the word God brought up a particular idea of him with which someone had tried to impress them during childhood. I didn't really grow up with any conception of God. My family, we didn't go to church. Probably part of that was because both of my parents growing up were in their alcoholism. But I really, especially in high school, I just hated God. I don't even, it's like really irrational now, but it kind of makes sense in light of what I've come to believe. But I just hated it. If anyone tried to talk to me about God, man, I wanted to slug you. So when I read that, some of us have been violently anti-religious, like I was like, all right, so some people have really like thought, like I thought, and like, you know, it talks in another part about how, you know, like, it, well, that's actually right here on the same page. Like, I had tried to be philosophically comforted as well. I tried to be moral, and I had just seen how that stuff had failed for me. So I was like, okay, well, if you guys have done it, I'll just believe that you believe. And that's what my sponsor told me. I didn't just come up with that. She said, well, just believe that I believe. And I was like, okay. So we moved forward, and my step three was actually really cool. It was definitely a God moment. My sponsor just randomly was like, oh, hey, like, do you want to go to Raven Cliffs to do your third step? Having no idea that, like, Raven Cliffs is, like, a really, which is just this, basically just this cliff formation up in around Helen, Georgia. Having no idea of the history that my family has there, like me and my brothers and my dad used to go up there all the time. And she was the one who brought it up. So that was kind of like this moment of like, wow, like that seemed kind of like predestined to happen, you know? Like that definitely wasn't, you know, me. So we did my third step there, and that was really good. And I feel like after my third step and after that experience, I had a desire to believe. And I had a desire to know God. whatever that meant, and I just kept searching. Step four, you know, so we made a decision, you know, to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, and so we launched into step four, and I launched not very well. It took me, I think, like 2 months to do my fourth step. I would not recommend it. There was a lot of bad decisions I made in that time, specifically with guys, because I feel like I sat on my fourth step for so long. But once I finally got it done and did that fifth step, you know, I was finally, I mean, it wasn't just like moment of like, you know, the clouds parted and the sun came down. It was definitely, I felt like, okay, I've earned my seat here. You know, like I've done some work and like those things don't have to have power over me anymore. Like I can pray and I realized that one of my biggest resentments was against God and against myself. So I was able to pray about that. So that's what my sponsor told me. Okay, like if we've seen these things, we've got many character defects, which are many, and now you need to pray for these people. I'm like, okay, pray for these people. All right. And guess what? It worked, you know? In 6 and 7, you know, I mean, you look at your character defects and you ask God to remove them, but it's a process. I don't feel like any of us have arrived there. It's cool as I continue to walk with God, just in the peeling of the onion, different stuff that is just continually revealed to me, and how cool it is when you do make progress on those things, and some of the stuff that you struggle with anymore, you don't. Like, I haven't been in a relationship in almost 2 years, and praise the Lord, like, it doesn't bother me most days. I'm not a saint, but, you know, that's just something as well, I mean, that I just was absolutely hopeless about. So, I think where I really turned a corner in my sobriety, what time is it? 8:40, okay. Where I really turned a corner in my sobriety and kind of went a different way than what I was going, was when I went back to school. So I'm 6 months sober. I had dropped out to get sober. I couldn't do it. I couldn't go to school and get sober, and that was good for me. That's what I needed. And so I went back to school, 6 months sober, and I thought I had, like, made a lot of progress. I thought, oh, I'm going to go back, and, like, things are going to be okay. I'm not going to be so in fear that I walk. It's kind of hard to describe unless you know Georgia State, but, like, there's a way to walk, like, underneath the school, kind of, like, underground, so no one sees you, instead of, like, walking through the courtyard where everyone can see you, and you see people you know, and you talk to people. I was, like, one of those underground people, because I didn't want to talk to anyone. I didn't want to see anyone I knew, and so I'm like, I'm going to go back, and, like, you know, like, I've done so much work, like, things are going to be great. And I went back, and I was absolutely paralyzed by fear still. And I was just, like, really hit just, like, this wall of just, like, I can't do this. And so throughout that summer, especially that month of August before I went back to school, I had been attending a church in just 2 miles down the road from my house that a friend of mine that I actually did drugs with growing up went to, and another friend from the program went to, and so I hit this just absolute bottom. I was one of those that had anxiety attacks because of whether perceived or real fear. Perceived a real danger that I felt from people and how they were thinking about me and what they were trying to say. And it's kind of hard to explain. I hope you kind of get what I'm saying. But I had one of those anxiety attacks, and I had been hearing all this stuff about, you know, God and Jesus, and didn't really want anything to do with it, actually. I honestly, on my fourth step, I wrote, like, one of my fears, because, you know, you have to write out your fear list. One of my fears was, I'm afraid I'm going to become a Christian. So, it's really ironic now looking back on it. But I didn't want it, because I knew on some level that that meant that a lot of these character defects were going to have to go. And we cling to them. And we think we know better. But I was broken to the point where I knew I saw my need of a Savior. And I'm grateful for that as well. Just as much as I'm grateful for my bottom, I'm grateful for the fact that I saw that I could not do it on my own and I needed someone to do it for me. I needed grace. I needed forgiveness. I needed the power to do what I can't do. And that's what I found in Christ. And so I gave, I said the prayer, but it wasn't until 2 weeks later that it really became real to me, where I had one of those moments, kind of like Bill talks about again, where, it's that spiritual mountaintop, where you finally find what you were looking for in that bottle. And from there, everything changed for me. I had been in sobriety, going after guys and still kind of like living a life that I would say wasn't really sober. I wasn't drinking, but really trying to grow spiritually, really trying to give back, really trying to give of myself, that wasn't really happening. And so I'm grateful for that time. And so moving forward, step nine was really cool to do. I did this all around the same time. So my spiritual life is, hitting this amazing new, era. Well, to me, it's really beginning. And I'm also getting to do step nine. And I still have some to do, honestly, that I haven't done yet. But big ones, major ones, family and close friends, I was able to do them. And I didn't really have any of those that people, it talks about some people might like slam the door in your face and blah, blah, blah. My experience with step nine was very much healing. And everyone pretty much said, we're proud of you and keep doing what you're doing, So, I guess, what it's like now is where we're at. Because of course 10, 11, and 12 are our maintenance steps. And man, step 12 has been where it has been at for me. Of course, clean house, trust God, clean house, help others. That has been, really what has kept me humble in this program. Because God just puts people in your life that are exactly like you, and you're like, that's exactly what I was like when I came in. And so it reminds you where you've come from and what you could lose if you don't keep trusting, keep putting one foot in front of the other. And so what it's like now, I finished school. I had about a year, two semesters, well, technically three, because I had to go to, I had to do one summer class. So I finished school, and then I had a lot of my identity in school. I was a good student, so that was me, I was a good student. That gave me worth, So I'm graduated, and now I don't have that anymore to find any sort of comfort in, or if that makes sense. And so that summer after I graduated was very hard. It was a time of really learning to trust God, trust the Lord, and His purposes for me, because I really had no idea what I wanted to do. I'd gotten this degree really just because at the time it seemed like the best thing to do, and it was also the easier, softer way, because the degree I got, it was challenging, wasn't as challenging as maybe a degree I would have chosen if I'd been sober. So I had this degree, and I had no idea what I wanted to do with it, and that summer was a lot of kind of like just backpedaling for me, but I finally, I had to go through what I had to go through, and the Lord brought a job for me. Actually, believe it or not, this crazy, violently anti-religious, anti-Christ girl starts working at a church for, I'm an assistant to the pastor. And that kind of like came full circle for me. I was like, this is crazy. Like, this is my story. It doesn't make sense apart from there's a God. Because how do you go from less than a year and a half. I think I had 18 months at this point. How do you go from, in less than 2 years, like someone who would have punched you in the face to working at a church? It doesn't make any sense. But it was really cool. And it was a time of spiritual growth for me. It was a time of learning those old lessons about that I can do my job and I don't have to get approval from everyone all the time. Because I was just really, just felt, I mean, like I was different, you know, and because on a real level I am. Not everyone's been through what I've been through. Not everyone's in those type of circles have seen what I've seen, have done what I've done. But not that there was any condemnation or anything from anyone, but it was just a time where I feel like issues in my own heart of approval and needing to be liked were kind of uprooted. Like, God was kind of like, no, you're not allowed to get those things from other people. You're supposed to get them from me. And I was also working at a toy store, and I was also getting involved in, just different ministry, and, because of that, this past summer, I went to, India, actually, to go and teach English there, work at a hospital, just different things like that, and again, it's like, God, something that, someone said recently, it has really just stuck in my mind, and it's really encouraging to me that the Bible is a hall of fame of losers, and if you read it, you see over and over again just the failures of people. Moses, how he, you know, he's like, no, God, I won't go and talk to Pharaoh because, you know, I'm not a very good orator, you know, and God's like, okay, you're an idiot, you know, like, and then, or Abraham is afraid of whoever the people are, and so he says, oh yeah, Sarah's not my wife, she's my sister, no big deal, you know, like just over and over and over again, just failures, but God uses us anyway, you know, and that's encouraging, coming from my background and my life, that I can be used despite the fact that I really don't have much to offer apart from Jesus. So and that was a really, I mean, it's just another, you know, it's just constantly growing, you know, and building, and sometimes you can't see it. Sometimes it's kind of like you feel like you're going in circles, but it's actually more like a screw where you're actually like, you actually are going somewhere, even if you can't really tell, until someone else tells you, you know, until someone else tells you, like, wow, like, I can, like, what have you done differently, and that's the cool thing. And sometimes it's hard to receive because you're like, it's not me, it's God, you know, it's not anything I deserve, you know, it's grace. I don't think I really understand what grace is. And I mean, a definition that I've heard is, you know, getting what you don't deserve. And it's so much more than that. But, you know, now I'm back here in Atlanta. I was in India for 2 months, and I'm looking to go for more long-term stuff, whatever God has. I'm willing to give anything to pursue God, whether anything. In Philippians 3:8, it says, Paul says, you know, like, I count everything as loss for the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. And that's me today, by the grace of God. And where did I get my start? Here in AA. You know? So I'm eternally grateful to this program for being a spiritual kindergarten for all of us. Being a place where I could come in and give the middle finger to God and you guys didn't care, you know? And that's something I carry with me when I meet people today. It doesn't offend me, you know, when people talk. I have a couple friends who really just think I've gone off the deep end. They're like, when are you going to get over this whole Jesus thing, you know? So yeah, someone actually said that to me the other day, my friend Patrick. And it's just like, you know, I'm able to take that stuff now because I understand, you know, where people are coming from. Because I was there. I was one of those people, for sure. And so now here, you know, my my life is really just as much as possible trying to give back, you know, what I have. I try to sponsor people as much as I can. I finally took my first sponsee through all 12 steps, and she actually got her own sponsee. She's sitting right there. So that was cool. Interesting, but cool. And that's just where it's at, like, to see her recover. That is the bright spot of my life today, to see her get this thing. She's actually picking up 9 months on Friday or Saturday. We'll get back to you. But before Katie, I had sponsored other girls, but she's the first one I had gotten through all 12 steps. So I feel like there was something else I was going to say. Well, I guess I could say I'm a nanny now for 4 kids. So I don't really understand why I have this job, but God is definitely sanctifying me through it. They're 8, 6, 3, and 1. And I just have no business doing a job, but because, you know, I depend on God and not myself, you know, things work out. And it's cool. I guess it's been cool just to, in that process of learning to let God do for us what we can't do for ourselves, just to see how much better He does it than we ever could. And just getting to have this new life that I don't deserve, you know. I didn't deserve it. I just think about the person who I used to be, the person who, you know, at the age of 16 called up my dad at 3, or actually the cops called up my dad at 3 in the morning, come get your daughter, she's tripping on acid. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was me. But that's not who I am today. And it was cool. I just went to, and then I'll finish up, but I just went to Missouri to visit my dad's sister and her kids, and my cousin, who has kids that are almost actually as old as I am, told me, he was like, you know, back a couple of, he's talking about before I was sober, like, I wouldn't have trusted you with my kids, and now I would trust you with anything. And that's just one of those things that's not me. I don't deserve that, but it's the gift that I got, and where I started was working the steps and taking it one day at a time. And so thank you for, you know, listening to me, and I hope, you know, I hope that you got something out of it. So thank you.
Very well done. Very well done. I wish I had a nanny like you. Michael, please come up here and give out the chips.
Hi, my name is Michael, recovering alcoholic. And here at the 8 o'clock meeting, speak with me, we have a chip system. We have a white chip for anybody who wants to start a new way of life. Silver chip for 30 days. Red chip for 90 days. Yellow chip for 6 months. Green chip for 9 months. Blue chip for birthdays. And I offer the white chip one more time if anybody want to reconsider. Thank God for the chip show.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, it's time for AA and NAVA Club related announcements. What we got? This weekend? Which
day? My name is Gary. I'm an alcoholic. We have the, this weekend is the AA Sober Woodstock. It's the Lake Lanier Legacy Resort, which is off of exit 12985. You know, it's any number of circuit speakers working through steps for the weekend. That includes Clancy, Sandy Beach, Bob and Sands. There's a bunch of wonderful people that have been doing this all over the country and elsewhere for a long time. And again, maybe they'll take you through step 1 to 12 for the weekend. It starts on Thursday at 8:30. It'll run through the weekend until Sunday morning.
My understanding is if you go up there Thursday night, it's free. And if you decide you want to stick, I think you can prepay 30 and then
35.
And then 35 if you show up the day for the whole weekend. No, that's it. Okay. Yes. How are you? Christmas. Thank you, Risa. Please do pass the word to anyone that you know that has kids every couple of weeks or whatever. They may want to try to plan on that weekend. It's always great. Santa Claus is going to be there. They're going to make Christmas cards and Christmas ornaments and lots of music, singing, and we want to thank Turning Point for donating a live Christmas tree downstairs. It is fabulous. Thank you, guys. Really do appreciate that. Yes, ma'am.
I'm a few people came in
late. I put some masks on the table. Okay, yeah. And when we break down, we're going to leave the chairs in place, but if anybody could help us straighten up, pick up cups, maybe clean up around the coffee urn. Did we get all the sheets on? Not yet? Okay, you going to come up and do that? Okay, and next week, Richard L. from the 7:30 early morning study group at NAVA tells his story. The week after that, Wildman, Alan Siegel. Some of you folks know who he is, and he's a riot. So that's going to be on December 12th. So the 5th is Richard, Alan's the 12th. Okay, how are we doing? Ready to go? All right, so I would like to remind everyone that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Ever reminding us to place principles for personalities, and for those who will, please join hands in the Lord's Prayer.
I'm going to Thank you.